This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Good Things, our Friday show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. I'm Darshan Johan and joining me on the show today is Deborah Priya Henry. She's the co-founder of Fuji, a nonprofit which champions equality and access for refugees through advocacy, education and entrepreneurship programs. Welcome to the show, Deborah. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a few years since I've been on BFM, so happy to be back.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to talk to you because the last time you came on the show, I wasn't part of BFM yet. So yeah, eager to get into this with you. Now, Deborah, perhaps we can start right from the top. Tell me a little bit about Fuji School. What is it and what do you all do exactly?
So yeah, it's, you know, it's been a long, almost 13 years now since I first met a refugee family here in Malaysia. I was in my early 20s and I had done a little bit of work for the UNHCR here. And I met a couple of refugee families, in fact, from different countries. And one family really stuck with me because they were from Somalia. They had come here, four siblings with their grandmother. And I was sitting in their home talking to them and, you know, interviewing them, finding out a little bit more about their lives. You know, do you go to school? What was life like back home? And they'd been in Malaysia for, I think, at least about 6 months at that point, and they weren't in school. Less than 20 minutes from our beautiful Petronas Twin Towers, they were, you know, not really educated, you know, couldn't write, couldn't read. And, you know, I come from a family where my mother's in education, my sister's in education. And for me, it was this really... It was one of those moments that, you know, you have these moments in your life. And it was, you know, we talk about food, water and shelter as basic needs for survival. Without these, you will surely die. But what about a child that does not have access to education? We are really setting them up for failure. And so I really remember when I was leaving their home that day, I was struck to do something beyond giving them a little donation and saying, you know, all the best, good luck. It was really, what can I do here? And doing something that's really transformational for their lives. And so my university friend and I, Shikin, gave them tuition for about 6 months. And in May of 2009, we set up Fuji School. And it's essentially a school with obviously a much smaller limited budget and resources, but we were essentially set up to educate children in this country who otherwise would not have access to school. And falling into that category are refugee children, stateless children. Any kid without a form of Malaysian citizenship or IC can't access our government schools. And yeah, fast forward 12 years, that's what we've continuously been doing. As an organization, we've grown and expanded our programs to do other things, but very much with a focus on education and access and opportunity, and really holding on to this premise that a child is at the center of everything we do. So, you know, whatever decisions we make, however we run, it's really thinking about what is in the best interest of a child, and what can we give them that's going to see them flourish, break out of that cycle of poverty, break out of that difficult the social circumstances that they're in. And be able to, you know, reach their full potential in life. And I think that's something that goes beyond, you know, the type of passport you have or how much money you have or, you know, where you belong or don't belong, so to speak.
Now, I'm very curious to know what exactly, you know, really inspired you to start this school? And I'm asking this because, you know, a lot of people, you know, have met refugees. And while a lot of people seem to empathize, it's not something that many people think about, like, okay, I'm going to start a school for these refugees. What inspired you? What actually pushed you to, you know, go in this direction? And I'm also wondering, why is this particular cause so important to you?
So I think it's a good, interesting question. Firstly, I think it's important to say that you have to find something that you are passionate about, that you actually care deeply about. And that can be animals, the environment, children, women's rights, education. You know, there are many needs in the world and there are many social issues, right? So it's important, I think, for people to find something that you connect with, because it's not easy. It's not something you can, you know, wake up in the morning and be and have the fire to keep going at it and keep doing it if you don't care and deeply enough. So that's the first thing. For me personally, I just think I've always cared about these issues. When I think back to my teens and my like 13, 14, when, you know, you're finishing school, you have to start thinking about what you want to study and do next. This was always something that kept coming up. And I cared deeply about, you know, I was very intrigued by war. I was very intrigued about suffering and, you know, how World War II happened, why it happens, why people fight, poverty. How do we live in a world with so much abundance, yet so many people suffer? You know, all of these kind of questions and conversations, right? Ones that are still not yet answered, sadly. But it interested me in my teens. And then when I started modeling, I had a lot of opportunities and I had a good platform to be able to get a lot more exposure. And I was able to travel the world. I saw a lot more of suffering. I visited refugee camps in Lebanon and I visited a lot of communities in India and Myanmar, in Brazil. So I had a lot of perspective and then I studied, my degree in university was in political science and economics. And I think that really solidified that for me anyway, that this was something that I wanted to do in a way that's not like, oh, you know, you're just doing a little bit of charity on the side. This is not that, you know, it's really running a nonprofit organization. You have a team, you have employees, you have the people that you work with. You have to fundraise a huge amount of money every year to be able to do this work. So it's not just a nice to have, oh, you're doing good or you're helping people. I think a lot of people, because I come from the fashion industry, a lot of people still see me as like a beauty queen model who does a bit of charity work.
Right.
Maybe they're stuck in the Miss Congeniality world kind of thing. I don't know. But it's really something that I dedicate the bulk of my time to, and it's real, and people rely on us. We run a school. I mean, our school right now, we have 200 students. It's not, you know, there's a plan. You need to think about what happens next year and the year after, and hence, you know, this COVID times has been extremely tough on not just us, other nonprofits as well. Yeah.
And I want to get into the COVID side of things a little bit later. I'm very curious, Deborah, why was it important to you to start a school as opposed to, just a charity organization, something, and not that, you know, charity organizations, there are different types of charity and things like that, and they are all very important. But I'm curious for you, why was the school element important as opposed to just, you know, doing something like, let's say, food aid, for example?
Yes. Well, I'm a firm believer in the charity is a short-term solution in terms of providing people things. I mean, the old age-old saying, you know, you teach someone how to fish and not give them fish, right? In emergency situations, like what we saw in the past 6 months with this white flag movement and such, this was critical, urgent, dire, in which case that's where you see a lot of charities and NGOs step up to fill those gaps, such as food aid, making sure people have food on their tables, they don't go hungry, critical medicine, healthcare, access. However, in the long run, that is not a solution. It's not sustainable. Nobody's going to just keep giving you millions and millions of dollars to do that kind of stuff in the long run. It is difficult. So that's one. In specifically when it comes to refugees, if you look around the world, people can remain refugees for up to 12 years. Right. That's more than a decade. And so having to live on handouts for that amount of time is difficult in any situation. And so I don't like doing that. I think temporarily it's great, short term it's great, long run you need to build sustainable solutions, and you need to shift the conversation away from creating dependency, which is handouts, and moving that away to self-reliance, which is then people need to be able to take care of themselves. And so even if you look at the Malaysian government and with Malaysian citizens, what do we do, right? How do you shift that conversation to people being able to fend for themselves, provide for themselves? And that's really investing in the individual. So for me, I always say, and I'm quoting someone here, I can't remember the person's name, but an education is the greatest gift you can give someone. And that is why we started the school, because it is, when you educate a child, you impact generations. This idea that you can just, I'm only going to educate one kid. That's only one person. It's never just the one person. I've seen it so many times, time and time again. When you educate that one boy or girl, they grow up, they have an impact on their family. Then they get married. They make different choices because they're educated. They may not get married as young. They may not, girls may not get married young before they finished university or got a job. They don't get pregnant as early and as quickly. They have bigger dreams for their children when they have children. And education also changes how they think about themselves and the environment around them. And so the spillover effect then goes from generation to generation. And you see this in many countries, in many different circumstances. So yeah, and hence Fuji School, right? A place where, imagine refugees in Malaysia not being able to go to any form of school if schools like Fuji School did not exist. And that's quite scary, that you'd have hundreds and hundreds of children sitting in our country just because they're not citizens or don't have the right documentation, are not allowed to access a form of learning. It's detrimental, not just for them, but for the whole society. So, yeah. And I think a big lesson that we all have to learn, I mean, I know you want to touch on the pandemic in a bit, is coming out of the pandemic is that we are living in an increasingly interconnected, interdependent world where one man's problem will become somebody else's problem. So this idea that of living in bubbles where, depriving other people of certain basic rights and thinking that it's not going to have long-term effects, I think is very foolish. And I think, Malaysia's done a fantastic job with the vaccination rollout. We vaccinated everybody, refugees, stateless, migrant workers, everybody, regardless of their status. So we can do it. The thing here is like, we can actually do it if we really want to. So I really think the time is now where we need to think about legality for refugees, opportunities for them while they are in this country, and that they can contribute to this country, and not this whole, they're just here to take from us, but they can actually give back and actually help this country economically as well. So
I think that's something interesting you brought up, this idea that people have about refugees, that they're just here to take from us. We've seen the level of xenophobia on display by the Malaysian public, especially heightened throughout the pandemic. The refugees were the ones blamed for the spread of the disease. Many have asked, activists and NGOs, if you go through, like, perhaps you have experienced it yourself, right? I've observed, when I look at Facebook comment sections on certain NGO groups and all, you see people asking, why would you guys help them? Shouldn't you be just focused on Malaysia right now? Malaysians are suffering. Even outside of the pandemic, there's this idea that refugees are here to steal our jobs, and all sorts of things, right? All sorts of assumptions that people have. How do you first process these sort of comments, and how do you respond to them?
Well, firstly, it's very hard for me to process that. I just cannot. I know it exists, and I've seen it on social media. I've met people like that. I just can't. I don't know. I can't internalize how someone can put themselves, create a hierarchy of humans, based on what religion, race, gender, nationality. Like, where do you draw the line? Once you start this game, it's a very dangerous, slippery slope when it comes to thinking some lives are more valuable than other lives. So it's something I completely don't resonate with. And for me, I grew up, I think it's a huge blessing to grow up mixed heritage. My mom's Irish, my dad's Malaysian. I'm a mix of two very different worlds in one, and it's very beautiful to be able to be that. And this idea that you got to pick a side, you got to prioritize I think it's a very archaic notion that people really need to stop fueling and looking at things through that perspective. Secondly, I think fear trumps facts, and a lot of people, leadership and otherwise, also fuel fear over fact. And that's very dangerous as well, because then the stuff that comes out sometimes in the news, the stuff that gets a lot of attention and spotlighted, is not actually reality. They take one story or one statistic and they blow it up like that's the big scary picture. So that's another very important thing to remember. And the same, like you said, blaming migrant workers and refugees for like COVID, like what on earth does that even mean? We all know how COVID works. Speak to any doctor, they'll explain it, right? So, you know, you've got to look at other factors, right? If you have migrant workers who work in these kongsis and you shove, you know, 50 or 100 of them into tiny spaces, clearly the virus is going to spread. So are you blaming them, or you're blaming the work conditions which are inhumane or unfair? Whose fault is it, right? So perspective is super important. I do think a lot of Malaysians have, even before the pandemic, do have this mindset of like us first and others after. But I think this also comes down to the way this country has been for many years, which is, you know, there's hierarchy. We always split people into racial groups, language groups. Everyone is distinguished based on all these, what I would call superficial criteria, right, as opposed to being humans or Malaysian. And I think therefore they apply the same, idea when it comes to then others, right? To help. And I've been asked so many times over the years, why refugees? Why not Malaysians? And I would say, like, are you waiting for the day when there isn't a single poor Malaysian left? Because if we're going to wait, if we're going to sit here and not help anyone else, not help animals, not help Palestinians, not help Afghan refugees now, not help people from natural disasters or the environment, until every Malaysian citizen or everyone here has got now, is not in poverty or whatever that is, when is that day going to come? It's never going to come. So, I just think it's super important for people to, you know, help people in your environment, in your circle. And I think the pandemic has shown us one really important message, is that, and I was talking to a friend about this a few days ago, where she said it forced me, because I was home so much, it forced me to really look at my immediate environment and to see where the needs were and who I can help. And that doesn't mean just your neighbors or just Malaysians. Mm. It means anything and everything that was then, that you were then conscious of, that you could then contribute. And you had neighbors doing these fundraisers in their neighborhoods and then donating to Fuji. And we were able to then give milk to moms, diapers to babies, food to people in need. And we did it, and we helped everybody regardless of, we were colorblind completely in terms of how we helped people. And just one more point to that, right, is that what I really saw in about June, July, when at the height of the needs that were going on in the community in this white flag situation, was I saw people come together in the most beautiful way. Despite the bickering and the stuff that you see on social media and, you know, everyone, the xenophobic sentiments that fly left and right, I saw on a huge, I just saw humanity at its best. People were donating money. If we looked at our bank account, we had donations from 10 ringgit all the way up to thousands of ringgit. People were giving what they could, and they didn't ask where it went. They didn't ask who it was going to. They just gave because they wanted to ensure that no one went hungry, that no child would go to bed on an empty stomach, that no baby would not have milk powder. That is such an important thing that we did. We did it. Society did it. Us living here, not necessarily our leadership and authorities and people out there. We did it as companies, as individuals, as neighbors, as friends, as family. So we can, and we did. And so I really hope people hold on to that kind of unity, that kind of Malaysianness, as we move forward. We don't lose that coming out of the pandemic, and, you know, with our elections, with our government, with our leadership, we don't allow things to divide us again. But we hold on to that, and realizing that, you know, we're all better off when we support each other, and that there is enough. You know, I was wondering, where is all this money coming from? Everyone's going through hard times, but people were giving. And so there is enough. I think that's the thing. There is enough. And for the refugees that are here, for them to be able to work and to contribute, for them to be able to get an education, for you to still benefit, for your kids as Malaysians to still get enough, like, there is enough. And I think once we really believe that, then it changes, I think, the whole picture.
On the show with me today is Deborah Priya Henry, co-founder of Fuji. After the break, I'll be asking her about her hope for the future. We'll be back with more on Good Things, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Deborah Priya Henry, co-founder of Fuji, a nonprofit which champions equality and access for refugees through advocacy, education, and even entrepreneurship programs. So, Deborah, we know that, you know, refugees who come to our shores because of the legal framework here, because of the laws that are in place, they do not have access to proper healthcare. They do not have access to proper education as well. And so, but what's interesting is Fuji School has tried to combat this, right? Because it's not just giving sort of an education for the younger kids. You guys actually have programs that prep them step by step so that they have the skills and they are prepared to even go to higher education, tertiary education, things like that. Perhaps you can talk to me a little bit about this. How do you prepare your students for higher education through the programs that you have?
So we see this, the journey of a child, right? So like anyone out there listening, your kids, even yourself, you start off at kindergarten, then you have primary school, high school, you finish high school, you start thinking about what's next. So free school has the kindy, primary and secondary school part. When we run the Fuji School out of the shop lot. And what we do with this education is we focus very much on academics. So your math, your science, your English, but a huge, huge focus is also on personal development, social and emotional development. So it is very often the things like even being in a football team, yoga classes, girls circles, like workshops that actually help build you as individuals. It is these kind of programs that actually really see transformation in the students when it comes to this. So the right kind of education is also extremely important. And then when you come to what's next, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of these refugee children and youth have missed out on years of education. So unlike many of us, they've not had the normal linear education journey. They've missed out on kindergarten, primary, chunks of secondary. And so we're playing catch up. They have to be able to learn fast enough to be able to get to a certain standard, to be able to do their Form 5, their O levels, and that sort of thing. So at that point, we kind of sit with them and we ask them, okay, well, what do you want to do next? Would you like to go to university? What would you like to do? Many opt for college university pathway. Many perhaps want to just get a job. They need to earn money to support their families. So they need to learn a skill and get a job. And then, of course, at some point, because Malaysia is only a transition point, meaning refugees are only here temporarily, many do get resettled to countries like Canada, America, Australia, New Zealand. So we're kind of like juggling a lot of things here, trying to do something in a short period of time or something that they can start in Malaysia. And if they get resettled, continue in the next country they go to. And so what we've done in that, we've actually launched very recently our high ed scholarship, which we're extremely excited about. And this is us taking a bit of a leap, right? We're going, look, we know there are refugees in Malaysia who are smart enough and deserving enough to go to university, but they can't because they don't have the money. Or because universities do not accept refugees because of legal issues, as you mentioned. So what we're doing is we're fundraising from corporations, from grants, from individuals to be able to pay full or part scholarship for deserving refugees to study, be it online or offline, at universities that accept them. And doing it in a way that if they do get resettled, they can continue that tertiary education in their next country. And we opened the application a couple of months ago and we had over 300 applicants. So this shows us that there is a need. And there are, imagine a kid who's so deserving and they won't be able to achieve that dream because they didn't have the money and nobody, like, you know, basically there wasn't even an avenue that said you can apply here to go. Mm. It's really sad. And so that's something that we're doing. We also work with and in doing that, we work with many different partners and companies to achieve that. And then also, you know, looking at vocational skills, can they learn carpentry, electronics, basic, even things like hairdressing and makeup, things like this that they can then, even cooking and baking, that they can then start jobs they can use to start jobs to support their families. So we kind of look at the whole journey. We can't just do sort of one part. We look at it all the way up and see how we can support individuals accessing services and also other opportunities. And to do that, we work with a lot of partners in Malaysia, but also in the region and globally to be able to achieve that. So, so we're always looking for partners, donors, people to go, you know what, an education changed my life. How many Malaysians are recipients of scholarships? And that changed drastically, right? How they live, help their families move out of poverty. Right. They're able to give their kids better education. So think about that when you think about a refugee's education. It's really the same thing. It's not two big, very different worlds. And we always say that, you know, Albert Einstein was a refugee, right? Mm-hmm. Imagine the world and give him a chance, you know, imagine the genius that is lost. And the same thing with so many other kids. It's that opportunity that's lost, that they will never be able to reach their full potential if not for somebody going, hey, you deserve this. I want to do this for you. So,
yeah. And how do you recruit teachers in your school? Are they all there on volunteer basis? And what about, let's say, someone who is not so academically inclined or interested, but they have skills, like you mentioned earlier, that perhaps they are interested in carpentry and all. Do you then send them to classes outside, or do you have like certain specialized teachers that come to the school to teach carpentry and things like that? How does that work usually?
Yeah, so most of our teachers, all of our teachers are paid because you need to have that dedication, that commitment. It is a very it's one of the hardest jobs. It's certainly one of the most undervalued jobs, I think, out there, our vocations. Mm-hmm. So we do hire about half of our teachers are refugees and the other half are individuals, Malaysians and otherwise, that work with us part-time. In terms of like students accessing opportunities, I think there's a certain bare minimum academically that students need to be able to achieve. But beyond that, if they have interests, we always try to find a way to connect them to that partner. Obviously, with the pandemic in the past few years, a lot of the hands-on training has come to a halt. But we have partner organizations we work with to sort of enable that. Mm. But the main thing here is that if refugees, and this is something we were actually advocating together with a lot of different people very strongly with the government over the past years, the government got very close to actually approving this, but allowing refugees to work is actually what we're trying to say, because when you allow when you grant them the right to work legally, and many refugees already work now anyway, it's considered illegal, right? But if you allow refugees to work legally, we can create frameworks around it. So we actually can monitor it, assess it, but also that person then, you know, potentially could pay tax. That person then earns an income, doesn't get exploited, which is good for Malaysia to not have more exploitation and things like that. But then also can pay for things, right? So they can pay for their kids' education. They can pay for services. So that also feeds back into our economy. And it moves families from this situation of no money, can't pay for anything, and us having to fundraise everything to pay for everything. It shifts the conversation to then, okay, these families have some money and they can pay for some stuff. And their family are taken care of better. You know, their healthcare will be better. Education is better. So it's better for everyone. So that's why we're really trying to push the conversation to allow refugees to work legally. And that will actually mean it will be better for everybody in totality.
I'm very curious, you know, how the pandemic has made things challenging for you guys, because it's, you know, there was a point where, you know, there was lockdowns, schools were closed, movements would have been difficult for your teachers. You know, even giving out aid also was very difficult for a lot of other NGOs as well. Talk to me about the challenges y'all faced over the past 1 to 2 years, and how did y'all how did y'all overcome these challenges?
I mean, and I think like most other NGOs out there, fundraising has been extremely hard. We rely 100% on funds, raised funds, public funds. So you know, corporations have not been able to give us as much. Individuals have not been able to give us as much. So it has been really, really tough trying to still keep the school open. Parents who normally pay a very marginal school fees have stopped paying school fees. So we're really running on like almost running on fumes here in trying to just imagine having to close the school. If we close the school, there's nowhere else these kids can go. So that's the really, really stark, harsh reality that we are facing. So we've just been, you know, in like overdrive trying to apply for grants and looking at opportunities everywhere. And, you know, we put stuff up on our social media, and even me personally on mine, to be like, guys, the school's really in dire need. We really need your help, please. You know, and that's not a good place to be for any nonprofit, because you need to plan. You can't live month to month, right? So, right. And that's why we really ask people, you know, go to our website, fuji.org, click the donate button. You can contribute, you know, 50, 60 ringgit a month to support someone's education. And if, imagine if 200 people can do that, that's educating that many more children, sustaining the school. So looking at different ways how we can fundraise has been important. Obviously the kids all studying online, that's been interesting because most of these kids, they live in, you know, small homes with many people. Right. Having that privacy and that ability to sit down and focus on class is difficult. Most families don't own laptops, so you're having to teach them using mobile phones. So imagine kids huddled around a little gadget, right, trying to learn math and science and English. Not easy, but we were able to maintain over 95% attendance rate. We transitioned online really fast, really well. We managed to get some extra tablets donated to us. Our teachers did fantastically with the transition. So honestly, I can't complain in that department. I think we did the best we could given circumstances and resources. It's been, I think I speak on behalf of like almost all nonprofits to say that it has been really, really challenging. And also beyond that, the needs of the communities, vulnerable and marginalized communities, has also grown. So from just needing help with, say, education, now families need help with rent, or they're going to get evicted and they'll be homeless. They need help with food. They need help with medical stuff. We've had pregnant mothers give birth and need to help us to help pay their delivery costs. So you see this trickle, spillover effect, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why we're talking now in Malaysia, saying the B40 community has now grown, because, you know, the middle income group has now trickled down into that. So, and I think the effects of that are not something that just get felt today and are gone tomorrow. They're going to be felt for the next period of time. So yes, it's a little bit scary, to be honest, when I think about it, but we're hopeful, and we have to be hopeful. We've been doing this for more than 10 years. Mm-hmm. Very often you feel like you're swimming against the current. I listened to interviews I gave, like probably interviews on BFM years ago, or like other interviews from like 6-7 years ago. And I feel like, oh my gosh, I'm saying the same thing. I sound like a broken what does that mean? What does that mean to be saying the same thing in 2000 and right. 2020?
It's very interesting, right? Because you say you've been saying the same thing. You know, you've helped a lot of people. You know, your school has helped a lot of people. A lot of people have managed to go on to get, do their bachelor's degrees or tertiary education, get resettled in different countries, thanks to the help of your school. But, you know, like you said, very little perhaps has changed in terms of like the laws, and various different things. You still see a lot of people coming to our shores every single year, and they're suffering. We still see a lot of xenophobia. You started Fuji in 2008. How do you reflect on these 13 years?
So I definitely think the average Malaysian knows much more about statelessness and refugees. You also look at what's going on in the world with what happened in Syria, what's happening now in Afghanistan. You re-understand the plight of refugees a little bit more. But I do think there remains, I don't know, a bit of a gap still in really, really being able to empathize with somebody else's situation. What does it really mean to be a refugee? And I always ask people this, that you know, that may be opposed to refugees coming in and stuff. I mean, I'm not someone who says open the gates and let everybody come here and not manage it. I'm not saying that. Of course, any country needs to manage its national security and think about things, right? I mean, that's important. But put yourself in somebody else's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
If God forbid there was a war that broke out in Malaysia today, if there were bombs dropping on your house, if your child was you never knew when your child went to school, if they were going to come home from school, if you lost everything, if life was unsafe, what would you do? And I think that taps back to the basic human element of every individual, no matter who we are, is survival. We survive. We find ways to survive. And to do that, you will cross a border illegally. You will get on a boat. You will get on a boat where the boat is safer. The risk on the boat is less than staying in your home country. You will probably knock on Singapore and Thailand's doors and go, let me in. So that's what we would do. I know I would do it. I know everyone I know would do it. And anyone out there who says they wouldn't, I'm not sure, you know, but, and that is it. And that's really what it means to be a refugee. It takes me back to the story in Lebanon. I had the privilege of being able to visit refugees from Syria that had walked from Syria into Lebanon, into this deserted area called Kar Valley. There's like this really dry kind of mountainous kind of area. And we sat in the home of this lady, not even a home, it was like literally a tent on the ground. And she said to me, she was sharing with us how she was walking from crossing the border and a stray bullet killed her child, her daughter.
Oh, dear.
And like, I carried my daughter with me on me, my dead child on me for all these hours to this foreign land in the middle of nowhere. And she's like, sister, do you want to see where I buried her? And she wanted to show me the plot, which was like 50 meters from their house. I mean, how heartbreaking is that? Like, that really, I mean, and I've seen a lot, and that really, like, I mean, it's, I remember it so vividly all these years later. And that's what it means to be a refugee, you know? Yes, of course, there's a lot of other stuff that can happen, but at the core of it, that's what it is. And that's where we need to be human and realize that somebody's suffering, and how can we as a people in a nation support that in some way? And you know, and that's why I do what I do, I think, because you see it, you hear it, you feel it, and you know how lives can be transformed when somebody has that opportunity to work and put effort into to building a better life for themselves and their families.
Certainly. Now, apart from Fuji School, you also run something called Fuji La. What can you tell us about this?
So this was really fun, maybe now slightly more stressful, but it started off to be a very fun idea. I've always not liked being 100% dependent on having to fundraise. And I wanted to start some sort of a social business that could financially support what we do. So about 4 years ago, we started Fujila. And it's a play on our branding, which is Fuji, and then La, being Malaysian. Also the Fuji's music band, the band, they are made up of a few refugees. So I thought it was very cool. And so we make jewelry and lifestyle accessories together with the refugee community. And we have three impact areas. One is we channel a percentage of profits back to the school, so back towards education. Secondly, we also work with refugee youth to make some of our jewelry. And they also learn skills and entrepreneurial skills as well. So if we have an upcoming bazaar booth pop up, they will manage the sales. They do inventory management, they customer relations, and all of that. So it's really offering opportunities as well to youth, raising funds for the school through selling our jewelry and products. But also, I think an important piece on this is an awareness piece, which is someone buys a pretty pair of earrings or a necklace and they go, oh, wow, this has an impact on someone's life, or this jewelry has a story to it. And I think that's where all of us out there have money that we spend every day. And so it's super important being more conscious and deliberate about where and how we spend our money. And so you're going to buy some jewelry and accessories. Why not with a brand that actually has an impact? So things like that. It's exciting for us. And then last year we did a super cool collaboration with a Malaysian designer, Kun Hui. And it was cool because it was literally in the middle of this pandemic. Mm-hmm. And we were all a bit like lost and dazed and confused. And we decided to use his leftover fabrics from his workshop and upcycle them into handbags that we sold. And people loved it. They sold out multiple times. And, you know, you realize in these difficult times, there's also some really nice opportunities. So we really hope people, you know, support us. People like jewelry and other accessories. And by buying things like this, it impacts, these little pleasures have a bigger impact on someone's life.
And how can people buy these jewelries or accessories or just support your school or organization in any way that, you know, they can?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're always happy to have discussions about ideas and collaborations. We like things to be versus just a one-off thing. Long-term is always better, but you can go to our website, fugee.org, and you can donate or get in touch with us. Also, if you want to look at our jewelry and stuff, we have you can go to Fugeela. So it's fugeelah.com. And we shop online, we ship internationally. I mean, we sell online and we ship internationally as well.
As we wrap this conversation up, Deborah, would you have a final message for us? What's your hope for the future?
That we can all be able to just rebuild our lives in ways, learn from what's been, I guess, learn. There are lessons to be learned from the past few years and be able to, you know, come at things with more, I think, compassion, more love, more empathy for each other and realize what really matters, right? At the end of the day. So yeah, I think as a country, we're so blessed. We have so much, such a beautiful country and so much abundance. I think for all of us to be smart about how we use what we use and realize that there's enough for everybody. And we're all in this, we're all more in this together than we realize. So yeah.
Thanks so much for speaking with me today, Deborah.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Deborah Priya Henry. She's the co-founder of Fuji, a nonprofit which champions equality and access for refugees through advocacy, education, and even entrepreneurship programs. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashan Johan, and this has been Good Things, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.